Chili Effect is sponsored by WallStreetWindow.com and listeners like you.
And now the most underrated voice in all media, Chuck O'Shelly.
February 10, 2022, allegedly, according to that thing we call a calendar. And this indeed is the show you were looking for. How do I know this? You can hear me. Anyway, it is Thursday, however it is you want to say it, the second to last broadcast day of the week for the O'Shelly Effect, but of course the network does what it does all during the week, so stick around and stay tuned to find out how that runs. In the first hour, we have Michael Swanson with us, the guy behind WallStreetWindow.com. WallStreetWindow.com is not just about Wall Street. Be in the know. Go there and follow the various news items. Some of them might be localized to a place near you, and some of them might be added to a place near you soon. Anyway, he's also the author of The War State, a book I always highly recommend, have recommended for many years. And who knows, maybe we'll talk a little bit about that before we're done tonight. And why the Vietnam War, a more recent one of three proposed volumes on the Vietnam War. So author, content creator, website guy, Wall Street guy, Mike Swanson in the first hour. In the second, here we go with the plans again. I have J.G. Michael and Joseph L. Flatley planned to show up. And last time I had J.G. Michael booked, he overslept. So let's see what happens there in the second hour. But, you know, author and podcaster and blogger, Mr. Flatley, along with J.G. Michael, the host of Parallax Views podcast. Yeah, that ought to be an interesting open discussion in the second hour. But again, let's get to Michael Swanson first. WallStreetWindow.com one more time. How you doing, Mike?
I'm doing pretty good. It's good to talk with you and know, you know, all the people out there listening to us, your audience of people, and they're good people. No one, I'm pretty safe to say that no one in the audience is wearing the metaverse goggles.
No
one has got a clear mind and able to listen to us.
Everybody is choosing what they put on their heads, and they are not choosing the metaverse goggles. I haven't seen one of these things in real life yet, but you know, we were talking about perceptions just before going to air, and
yeah,
a couple of interesting historical things. Maybe we'll get there too, but no, it does not seem as though my audience would be the people that are happily going over to the rebranded Facebook Meta over there. Is it still tumbling in the market, or has it stabilized, Mike? I stopped paying attention.
Oh, it's probably got farther, much farther to go.
Okay.
But you look, if you're not wearing them, I'm assuming no one is listening to us.
No.
If you go outside tonight, you got a good enough telescope, you can find a rocket. It's visible in the sky, and it's an Elon Musk rocket. In fact, if you go to Google, you can find stories on it. If you type Elon Musk moon rocket, there's all these stories about this. And there's a rocket, an Elon Musk rocket.
Okay.
It's heading to the moon, and it's set to hit it on March the 4th.
Really?
And no one's talking about it.
I didn't even know.
Thing has malfunctioned. this is like, all right, I'm skeptical of a lot of this techno babble. That's what I think he's presented a lot and mastered it to get people interested in his company, the stock, to buy it. And it's worked for him. And at the same time, I think now that's what is going on with Facebook, the Elon Musk rocket, it's kind of a, you know, it's like the joke of how good is all this technology really in the end? How much innovation is there really? I mean, there are sometimes huge innovative products, and we've seen some in our lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
For example, when we were children, the personal computer, around 1980, people were buying, or could, the personal computer, if they had enough money. They're extremely expensive, but they were out there. But then I think by around 2000, the development of that personal computer really hasn't been revolutionized, or nothing incredible has really happened in 20 or 30 years the personal computer. I'm using a laptop right now that's 11 years old. You know, so
yeah. So to counterbalance that, though, I would say that those personal computers that I initially saw in the very early 80s, I mean, nowadays they don't weigh 50 pounds. You know?
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, there's innovation, but
yeah.
Yeah, I mean, this is nothing like the Apple, but I think at some point all these great technologies, they come out,
mm-hmm.
but they do reach a point where there's really nothing you can do to improve them much more. And maybe something completely different will come along. And so, for example, if you forget about the computer, you know, in the past couple hundred years, probably the single biggest invention of anything, if you want to make 10 of them or something, was the railroad. You know, the railroad was the first step in being able to transport goods and people across the entire country in a much shorter amount of time. What could have taken weeks to go across the country took days. So that helped create the entire Industrial Revolution. It changed entire countries when the railroad was introduced into like Japan and Europe and so forth. Their entire societies were truly changed in ways beyond what we've seen in our lifetimes.
Well, this is transportation evolution, which is a little different because, look, the railroad, then followed by the airplane, refinements in shipping as far as, you know, on the ocean. Because typically, you know, all that stuff, if you had to do it internationally, had to be done with a ship on an ocean. Sorry for lack
of... But right now, though, if you take the railroad,
mm-hmm.
it's not really been improved. You can't really make the trains go much faster than they were 50 years ago or maybe even 100 years ago. Yeah, the airplane came along, but the airplane was something new, you know,
well,
completely different.
Well, they do have very fast trains now. I mean, things that move at the, you know, they're literally called bullet trains. There is the design out there for the maglev train, which has a different type of propulsion. You can still have mass people movers like that and product movers, you know, over land, and it is more efficient. You know, the locomotive, especially the steam engine, is, you know, not really doing so well against some of these newer technologies. Now, did it need to evolve is another question, because now we have airplanes that'll make jumps, you know, in a matter of hours as opposed to the days. You see, there's always the force multiplier aspect of it. And there are, you know what, cargo planes and all kinds of U.S. postal planes and things up in the sky outside of what just carries people to different destinations, right? So you have all of these different elements that continue to evolve, but at a certain point, yes, indeed, you may not need to send pieces of paper in a lot of cases now because you can send it electronically and you can do that instantaneously. I mean, there's a whole evolution depending on what your goal is. And, of course, these conveyances allowed people to spread around in places where they normally wouldn't have before because it was too much of a distance. You have to travel up a mountain, whatever. You know, and this changed everything, sure. But at a certain point, the conveyance starts to sort of peter out as a factor, doesn't it? You know, it becomes commonplace. And this is sort of what's happening with the technology, right?
Well, I think I'm using this all as a metaphor for what may be happening with the internet.
Okay.
And, you know, the internet, we've seen it explode in our lifetime, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
But Facebook, it's earning, you know, it's a stock, and it's gone up for years up until recently when it crashed 20%
right.
just the other week. And it's been called a growth stock.
Okay.
And growth stocks are ones that they tend to seem to go up. People buy them because the prices go up. But the whole rationale is that the earnings are increasing and the revenues are growing. The company's growing in revenue and earnings, and that's supposed to justify the increase in the price of the stock. Mm-hmm. And that's been the story for Facebook until just the past 6 months or so.
Right.
Now, the Facebook website, the number of users has actually shrunk, and the advertising revenue has declined. And all this came out just the other week in the earnings report. Now, at the same time, in the past roughly 6 months ago, the company began to heavily market and push this idea that they're now developing the metaverse.
Right.
And that's going to be the next big thing. However, in that last earnings report just recently, they said this isn't really going to come to fruition for 10 years.
Okay.
And we're going to have to spend billions to try to make it happen. Right. And the thing is, Facebook is no longer, as a result of all this, really a growth company. When you look at the fundamentals of its revenue and its earnings, they're simply not growing. Expenses are not growing.
Okay.
And people are being told, oh, this company's sort of now like Tesla. Don't think about the earnings. Don't think about the revenue. Don't look at the balance sheet. It's all about the concept, metaverse. And you're just supposed to believe in that and think this one company is going to now create this new thing called the metaverse.
Right.
And it's just going to be the biggest thing, the next iteration of the internet.
Yeah.
And you got to get in now to be a part of that. And I'm asking myself if I'm very skeptical that it's real. The way they say it is, that it's going to be as widely adopted.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to wear goggles no more than I want to ride in a robot car.
Right.
You know, I'm just not going to do it. And I don't think, and I think there's a lot of people like me who aren't going to do it. And I certainly am not going to sit at a table and put on these goggles and pretend I'm talking to you in the same room. You know, I got to see you in these goggles. I'm just as happy to talk with you with pure audio like we're doing now. I don't need to see some bizarre computer generation image of you or the people in your audience. I just don't need it.
Well,
so,
okay.
If that's the case, what if, I'm asking myself, what if what this actually may mean is that we have reached sort of a point where there's really not going to be much more innovation coming or new things coming that's really going to change the internet as we know it as it is. I mean, the latest evolution of it, what's the word for it? This idea of but they're tracking you all the time and using that data to make money, you know, make money from the surplus data they're getting and spying on you all the time.
Well, surveillance capitalism. Basically.
Surveillance capital. Yeah, that's the phrase I'm trying to think of.
Yeah.
So
well, look,
that book came out and I think it's, I'm not dismissing the book. I think they got very good arguments and I think, you know, they lay out the case pretty succinctly of what these companies are doing. But what if what they are describing in that book is actually the peak end game of the internet, and we're already there, basically, and this is it?
Well, see, here's my question for you then. Are we?
Yeah.
Because let's rewind a little bit. There was this little company called Amazon.
Yeah,
which,
sure.
You know, at a certain point before the tech bubble burst, was part of, that whole, the internet's going to be the thing and invest in all these dot-com startups, et cetera, right? And Amazon was at the forefront of that at the time, which is interesting enough, but it kind of went with the collapse and then came back. And now it's an entirely different entity, right? It became something. It was just a place to sell books and CDs, in the 90s. It became a much bigger retail thing, and now it's this dominant force across the planet, which, by the way, Elon Musk, maybe he should have checked in with Bezos over there, because Bezos could at least get Captain Kirk up into space and back with no problems, right? So he should have checked with him. The whole bizarre space race thing, I get it. It's like a metaphor. Now there's this rocket just on its way to the moon. It's not working right. It's hilarious because Musk, no matter what he does, whether it's with his cars or SpaceX or anything else, it always goes sideways, and somehow people continue to dump money into him and invest and keep his value up.
Yeah, they do.
Weird thing going on. So I don't know what this means for Meta, because simply the idea that maybe Facebook is kind of pointless, it doesn't mean that augmented reality as a business isn't going to pick up. I mean, we were watching Pokemon Go a couple of years ago, and, you know, people walking into traffic and getting hurt and all that, and that was one sort of news story about it. But the idea that there was a game now that literally overlaid the Unreal elements into the real world and allowed you to interact with it, you know, everybody kind of took it as a joke, and okay, it's a video game trend, but think about it. If you can do this, and I know you don't need to speak to me and see the room I'm sitting in and all that, but let's just say you didn't want to pay. See, now here we go with the conveyance issue. Now you don't need to fly to meet with me, because I can show you everything, my product model, my charts. You can evaluate my behavior based on the fact that you have a direct video feed that projects a 3D image at you, right? So now you can do business meetings without ever seeing somebody face to face at all. Okay, you can see products that are on the other side of the world about as well as you could if you flew there and saw them yourself. So I mean, there's something to be said here, where I don't know if this means we're at the peak or if we're at another turning point where, yeah, maybe Facebook will fall down, but the augmented reality business, which is the rest of Meta with the goggles and all the nonsense, maybe there's something to that, and it'll have more of a practical application, right? I mean, I'm just asking the questions here, Mike. I'm not trying to argue with you. I'm just saying, isn't it possible that this is going to become another, you know, it's like commonplace now to sit here and talk on, you know, if we wanted to turn on our videos on Skype, we could do that and see each other.
Sure. That's right.
Well, that used to be science fiction. That used to be spy movie stuff from James Bond era where, you know, right, he's got a little TV he can talk to you on. Nowadays, you can do that. It's not a problem. It's easy. Matter of fact, it's not even expensive, generally speaking. So there is a significance to it, I think, in that it can change the behaviors of a lot of things. You can do a lot of things remotely that you had to be in person for before. So let's just say you and I want to sue somebody in Alaska. Well, we can do that via Zoom. You know, our lawyer from, you know, Alaska can get on Zoom, not even be in the courtroom, talk to the judge. You and I can be sitting there observing and be called to testify. And meanwhile, I'm in Georgia. You're you know, north of me a bit. Why not? It's an interesting thought process is all I'm saying. I'm not saying it's good for anybody. I'm just saying that no matter what, this is the way it's going to go. And look, every technology peaks out and every technology takes another turn. I mean, television, when we were kids, again, was what? The primary way you could access visual and audio information from a distance. I mean, it was the thing. If there was a worldwide news event, this is how you'd get it. On your antenna, you'd sit there with your magic box. And you could see, here's the wreckage from the bombs in Beirut. You could see, here's the hijacking of a plane. When we were kids, these things were on TV, by the way. You could see the ridiculousness of the royal wedding, right, from the other side of the world. Okay. Whatever. The space shuttle, when it launched, you could watch it, even though we weren't in Cape Canaveral, Cape Kennedy, whatever they called it at the time. So I'm just saying that there's something to be said about the evolution and how these things actually finally settle in. Now, that aside, there's a difference between that and the speculation that goes on, which booms and busts. Like I said, Amazon is something that I do believe busted along with everything else in the late 90s, right? I mean, that tech bubble, it took down Amazon for a bit. They survived, and evolved out of that. I'm not saying everything does, but what I am saying is that isn't that another way to look at this? That eventually there will be some sort of equilibrium that'll build up where a practical application for some of these technologies will actually drive the need for their existence or the desire for their existence, at least until something comes along to replace it. What are your thoughts on that?
Oh, no, I believe what you just said. I'm just very skeptical that, there's inventions made all the time, and for mm-hmm. each one that really takes off, there's many that don't amount to anything. They just, something else is better, or people just don't need it. And it's hard to predict.
Yeah, even Apple
I can't predict which one is going to be.
Well, sure, but even Apple, right? Even Apple as a company, though, if you think about it, it was that big clunky computer they had at first, right? And they brought those to schools and they taught us a basic computer language that nobody uses, except Apple. And you couldn't have one of these things in your home. And if you did, I mean, it was like, what would you do with it? You'd play games with it. It was connected to nothing. You could keep records on it, I guess, and you could keep records on discs and such, whatever. But Apple, it wasn't really worth a lot. And at a certain point, it basically went bust. And what happened? Their biggest competitor bailed them out, right? And Apple came out with these little things called iPods and so on and so forth, and now we have the iPhone. I mean, and they are a tech competitor once again, but at a certain point, they went bust too. There was a certain point somebody would have said, what are you, an idiot? You don't have Apple stock? What are you, an idiot? You have Apple stock? And nowadays, it's like, it's just the Cadillac sitting on the lot. Yeah, of course, that's Apple stock, right, as far as investment goes. It's very interesting to watch how these things evolve, boom, bust, and some things survive and some things don't. I mean, Microsoft, what was it at one point? Not much. It was a company that gave you some software. And now what does it do? I mean, even Google, right? Google, which was a search engine, nowadays, you know what? They make electronics. Even Facebook, actually, funny thing, Facebook itself, before this Meta launch, was trying to sell you the, we have your, like, standby Facebook phone, the portal, right? I doubt that that's going to last, because who gives a crap? You can do it on your phone, you can do it on any computer. What's so special about why do I got to buy a portal? And mm-hmm. another fun thing is, even though Microsoft, clearly dwarfed Apple when it came to software and stuff, Apple had an iPod and Microsoft had a Zune, right? The Zune, from what I understand, because I never owned one, it was more expensive. It was a little more difficult to work with, but it was better quality. Didn't matter. Apple beat them out in the market. You know what I'm saying? So it is what it is. There are different evolutions. There's going to be different things that happen. I mean, I don't know how organic it is or how it actually relates to people's investments, though. That's the weird thing here is, people might be betting on the potential of Meta at this point in time. And of course, the Robin Hood people are going to swing and sway as they do. I don't know what their biggest draw is if you're a Robin Hood type investor, but honestly, I mean, it's just one of these things where it's like, first you got to accept that it's disconnected from the reality of the company. And secondly, it could be influenced by the reality of the company or the reality of the company's products, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, Samsung took a hit for a little bit, that company. They took a serious hit because some of their phones were exploding, right? But now that it's all okay again, isn't it? You know what I'm saying? It's like this stuff, I don't know what to make of it, especially with tech and investment. It seems to be way more volatile and way more based on anything other than logic than I can figure out. Maybe I'm wrong about that, Mike. I mean, please, help me out.
Oh, it's just... It's just a financial market. If it's a bull market, people want to buy into whatever they think is going up or see going up, and when it isn't, then they're in trouble. So that's where we're at now.
And no matter what your logical formula is, either A, it won't work, or B, it'll only work for a little while. So, it's truly, I mean, maybe I'm wrong about that too. And you know, it's like, no, it's okay. You can see certain trends, and there are sensible ways to look at this. But honestly, it just seems to me like, yeah, your formula works for a little while, and the true genius here is the guy who can figure out how to get in and out of those formulas before, you know, on their way up and before they collapse. And there you go. That's your winner. It's like the old parachute game. You ever play that in a group somewhere, Mike, with the parachute, where you know you flop up the parachute in the air, and then somebody's supposed to run straight across before the parachute comes down on them? It just seems like it's the parachute game in investment when it comes to tech. That thing starts to go up, you can start to run as it's going up, and you'll do well. You'll get all the way over to the other side, safe and sound. But if you run a little too late, that thing might just fall right down on you.
What happens with the financial markets is people get whatever is happening at the moment, and has happened in the past 6 months, they expect to keep going on forever. Mm-hmm. And then they get trapped eventually when, as you mentioned, it changes. So, huh. And things are starting to change. And that's the moment it's at. I mean, right, the Facebook stock was 380 in September. Now it's 220. You know, it's crashed. Right. Netflix has crashed. Many of these stocks are just falling. And the people that talk about the stock market or go to YouTube and type stock market and look at the videos, and everyone talks like Facebook and these companies are just creating the whole new world, and you just got to keep believing. And you know, that's what they're saying. That's what's making me ramble on about it, because it's just kind of crazy. But you know, we were talking before the show, you know, that's how the news cycle is now, and how reality seems to be. It's just what is happening at the moment gets magnified to be as if it's the biggest thing that's ever happened. So,
right.
You know, Musk shoots a rocket up, or Bezos does, and these things are treated as if they're as big as, you know, as important as the Apollo program or something.
Mm-hmm.
When they're not, you know, they're not changing human history or doing anything really new.
No, and the funny thing about the Musk rocket here is that I remember reading about it before it was going to happen, and I decided I wasn't going to pay attention to it. Because it's just, well, okay, so he's shooting a rocket to the moon to drop something off, from what I understand. That's it. I don't know what the purpose is.
It's like a stunt.
And
going
it's just
wrong.
Yeah, it's just a stunt. Now it's malfunctioning.
And what is he going to suffer consequences? I mean, if I took a dog to the park and walked the dog and it pooped on the grass and I just walked away and didn't do anything about it and the police saw me, I could get fined and maybe put in jail if I got crazy about it. But he can cause a rocket to hit the moon in next month, and will he be fined?
Yeah, I mean, what'll happen if that rocket, you know, does something crazy, like breaks off something and it falls to Earth, and you know, who knows? I don't even know what to say anymore, because this guy doesn't suffer consequences. When again, his company doesn't deliver cars. Oh well, he's fine. He turns around and he gets called on the carpet for, you know, overamping his stock and manipulating by you know, doing these things in public that are supposed to be illegal based on the SEC regulations. And where do those charges go? Nowhere. You know what I'm saying? Like, nothing ever hits this guy. I don't know
and
what to say. Yeah.
Him and his buddy Peter Thiel talk like they're libertarians and all this kind of stuff. And most of their money is made from government contracts.
Right.
Yeah, so what is that? And they're funding, or Thiel is at least, you know, funding all these real extreme right-wing candidates that are pro-defense, of course.
Yeah.
But you know, say they're for no government and anything else.
Yeah, and Thiel was on the board for Meta, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was.
And so he got...
Until just last week?
Yeah, until just last week he got off. And that's the funny thing, again, is that with Musk, right, It's just, you know, I mean, they talk all this crap about what it is they're going to do. And yeah, most of the money, even for the Teslas, right? You know, the vehicles, everybody's like, okay, he's got the, first of all, he's got problems with seatbelts. He's got problems with batteries. He's got problems with delivering on time. All this stuff, nobody is really hurting him financially for it. Number one. Number two, there's like a rebate that people were getting from the government. Basically, those cars were all government subsidized, and nobody made him pay consequence for taking government money and not being able to deliver cars even on time. Right? I mean, I've never seen anything like this in my life. It's like, you know, I don't get it. It used to be the smallest scandal, you know, would get the CEO of a company removed, even if they started it. Even a couple of years ago, if you remember the guy who was like running Papa John's, right? They kicked they kicked him off of his own board because of his racist comments. But, you know, I mean, look, his pizza sucks, but I mean, nobody was getting poisoned. And they literally had to rehab that company with Shaquille O'Neal. I mean, bring him in. I'm the new, I own a Papa John's. And he would come out, you know, big giant voice, giant guy. Shaquille O'Neal, I own a Papa John's, so we're going to do things different. And clearly they were just like, look, we have black people involved in our business. Just
picture
so you know.
This story.
You know,
it,
yeah.
It 90 miles from me, there is an old man living in the country, you know, his wife in the middle of nowhere.
Sure.
Dirt road. He comes out of his house, and Shaquille O'Neal jumps out of the sky with five other people with guns and grabs him. And he had a heart attack. And what happened was Shaquille O'Neal had joined the state, I think it was the state police. and they mistakenly thought this little man was some sort of pedophile or something. And did this to him. So I mean, it's just kind of, it's just what he, it's just crazy, you know. It was one of these weird things happened, you know.
No, I got you, but Shaquille. Right,
you know, just an hour away from me. It's
that's
weird.
No, I got you. It's the strangest thing with Shaquille though, because although he is the this giant, really, he's like a giant dude. Even though he is, you know, this huge giant dude, and he looks kind of mean and everything else, he's notoriously a nice guy. You know, and completely like, you know, one of the kindest people and talks calm, doesn't get angry at anybody. Never, I don't remember Shaquille ever having a real scandal against him.
They kept this shush, but what they're doing, it was like a PR thing, you know, when the help the children type, you know, the authorities are helping the children, getting the pedophiles or people looking at porno or whatever it was. And they got Shaquille O'Neal in this organization, like probably maybe he was donating his time, you know, and getting a tax write-off. I don't know.
Who knows?
Knows what it was, or just he likes the police, whatever it is. And it just turned into this terrible tragedy where, oh, let's go out and do a raid. Okay. And it, you know, that's what happened. So it's like, geez.
I you know what? I don't even remember that story. If you got a link to it, man, send it to me in email because I'd love to share that with people. Here's a weird story for you.
It's been a very long time. Probably 20. It's been a long time.
Well, either way, I mean, you remember this whole thing a couple of years ago. Again, he's got a squeaky clean image. Even in that case, he probably had the best intentions, Shaquille O'Neal. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I'm not.
It's just, you know, this is the way it turned out, but no, look, and I'll tell you what, if a guy Shaquille O'Neal's size was banging on my door angrily, I might be nervous. Just saying. I don't know if I'd have a heart attack. I know I'd be nervous. It's a big dude.
It was, okay, I'm finding on Google, 2007, I think it happened.
Jesus. It's 15 years ago.
Bedford County, Virginia.
Okay.
Yeah.
No, I didn't even know about it. That's something. I'm told I laugh too much on the show, Mike. I'm sorry, but that's worthy of laughing. I'm sorry. I can't help it, guys.
Yeah, I found it. Here's the article. Yeah.
No, okay, cool.
The guy's name was AJ Knuckles. He's there with his wife and two children. SWAT team of Shaquille O'Neal.
AJ Knuckles. You know, at some point in your life, you're going to have a SWAT team at your door if your name is AJ Knuckles. I'm just saying, but yeah, go ahead.
They thought he was a child pornographer.
Right. Turns out he wasn't.
This is how he described what happened. Men ran at me, dropped in a shooting position, double-handed semi-automatic pistols pointed at me and made me put my hands against my truck. I was held at gunpoint, searched, taunted, let into the house. I had no idea what this was about. I was scared beyond description. O'Neill says the story. He was part of the raid as an honorary deputy. He had no training on the raid.
Mm.
And so I guess that's something they're making an issue out of.
Well, even so, the guy, you know, somebody says, look, Shaquille, you're a big celebrity. Come on along with us. And I mean, I can see it happening. And I
now, he's
even,
got his own version, according to this, though.
Okay.
This is, I mean, this is O'Neill in the story.
Sure, go ahead.
I'll just read this to you. It ain't no story. We did everything right, went to the judge, got a warrant. You know, they made it seem like we beat him up. That never happened. We went in, talked to him, took some stuff, returned it. Bada bam, bada bing.
Okay. I believe.
That's what he said.
I believe that Shaquille saw it that way.
That's how he saw it.
I absolutely believe that he saw it that way. You see, I'm just saying, it just, he's the guy who is, you know, well known to not be like a hothead or a bad guy.
Yeah.
You know, probably true believer. He was like, oh, great, I get to, you know, be like as if I was a cop because I maybe had a fantasy about it. Who knows?
Yeah.
And he probably went in there full best intentions. And the cops went and they got the warrant and all. So, you know, oh, is that you putting that in the chat room?
Yeah.
It's in the chat room at Ocelli.com. The story. Oh, my God.
And actually, Radley Balco wrote it. See, I wouldn't have known who he was back then, 2007. I know who he is now.
Because
that's a reporter that specialized in, you know, reporting about the police.
Nice. And this guy, yeah, literally titles the article Shaq Attack, which is hilarious. Oh, wow.
But that's one of those, you know, it's one of those little news items that, you know, I read and never forgot. And
I never ran across it. I don't remember this at all.
Yeah, one of these, it's just so odd. Well, I remember because it happened near where I live. That's the real reason, I'm sure.
Well, you know, that's true. And that's the funny thing about what we were talking about before we went to air.
Yeah.
Is that you said something to me and I went, yeah, of course. You remember stuff that happens near you, or at least you used to. I don't know if things are so decentralized now that nobody pays attention to what happens in their own towns. But I got to tell you that sometimes I contact people and I ask them about stuff going on in their own town. And they're like, I don't know. They don't know anything about it a lot of times
that's
when
scary.
I'm following up on news stories. But it used to be, you know, in the days before the decentralization of the online world, we used to know about stuff. And one of the things that you brought up is, and this was before we went to air, guys, so I'm just telling you, it was funny to me because you said, look, I'm reading about all these riots in the 60s and 70s. And, you know, how people freaked out. Oh, you know, during this summer, George Floyd, you know, that whole thing, the whole country was on fire and people were dying. And they amped it up like, you know, as if it was this grand disaster where, you know, indeed some property was destroyed. But all these people are killing people, all the, you know, Antifa, blah, blah, blah. Okay. The death count is just not that high for a nationwide event. It's nothing, in fact. All right. And the reason why I know this and have this perspective is because Mike's looking and going, hey, did you realize, you know, in 67, there was a riot in Newark, New Jersey. And being from Jersey, trust me, you know this. If you were there, you know, after that event, it was a legendary thing discussed for a very long time and had very long-term ramifications. I've talked on this show about Asbury Park and what happened after the event there, which was much smaller than in Newark. But if anybody wants to go back in their memory a bit, when the movie The Many Saints of Newark came out, I talked about it a little bit. And I said, yeah, they actually do a good job depicting the 67 riot in Newark, which was racially motivated, which did a lot of damage. And guess what?
Well,
there was a lot of people killed.
I'm looking as, you know, just looking up as we're speaking about this.
Yeah.
Okay, in the 2020 riots, the estimate is about 25 Americans were killed.
Yeah.
And two police officers.
Right.
Two police officers. These Newark riots, it looks as if there were 35 people killed, mm-hmm. and three police officers were killed.
Mm-hmm.
So three police officers were killed in this one riot in Newark in 1967 in one city, and, you know, compared to two in the whole country
right.
in 2020. And the Newark riot was one of hundreds, over 100 that took place. From like 64 to 72, 73 or so.
Over the course of many years in many locations, yeah. whether it was Watts or Detroit, or there was some riots in North Carolina, all over the country, right? And over the course of that many years there, each one of these separate incidents, many of them, much worse than the total of what happened during one summer. Where people were freaking out, saying that there was this mass destruction and mass amount of casualties. And the truth about the Newark riots, by the way, is that I promise you that there were deaths not attached to it. People that died a few days later, people that died in events that were the run-up to the night when all hell really broke loose in Newark. And how do I know this? Because I heard about it when I was a kid. I mean, I heard about it. I was born a few years after, 5 years after. But I assure you that, you know, 10 years later, the adults that were around at that time were still talking about it. And the events that happened in Asbury Park happened later. And it wasn't, you know, didn't have the same body count as Newark. But it was pretty rough. And it crippled the area known as Asbury Park ever after, until it was gentrified a few years ago and revitalized. Newark survived. But it was forever marred in certain places. I mean, it's still probably still you could see signs of it today, even in Newark, where, you know, some old buildings maybe weren't torn down, where maybe some bullets were fired and some fires had been set nearby and scorched, you know, the sides of buildings and stuff. You can still find that stuff, I bet. I don't know what Asbury Park looks like today. I've just seen it online and I'm just like freaked out by how, you know, there's wine stores in Asbury Park. Wine stores. That's hilarious.
Hey, where I
antiques.
I'll tell you something. Where I live, there's a police chief in, I'm not sure how, he hasn't been on the force for too long.
Okay.
Let me see, maybe 5 years.
Sure.
I could be wrong. It could be seven or something, but he's been on long, 4 years. Okay. Okay, this guy's been on he's been the police chief for 4 years, and the crime has gone down, and I'm not complaining about him, but people where I live have no idea. I mean, I live in a very conservative area, right?
Right.
They have no idea that this guy... He put out a book last year that advocates defunding the police. Mm-hmm. You know, like, I mean, they would flip out if they knew this. And what he's doing in the book, it's very short. He co-wrote it with someone else that works for the, does gang programs.
Okay.
Get kids out of gangs or encourage them not to get in them by showing them alternatives and so forth. And, you know, it's supposedly a very successful program. And they're basically kind of laying out in this book the different things they've done that has worked. But he's got a chapter title saying he supports defund the police. Now, his way he says this is that he doesn't mean eliminate the police, but... that there's things that the police should not do that it would be better if other people are doing. You know, if there's psychological problems with somebody, get a counselor or something to talk to them. I mean, it all sounds reasonable, you know, what the guy's saying. The book, you know, I'm not arguing against it. It's just kind of funny to me that he's written this book. And it's a, you know, just the phrase of it would drive people crazy. And it's probably written to be a job resume or something one day in the future. I mean, that's what it looks like to me. You know, right. Go to a bigger city or something.
Yeah, sure, sure. And look, the idea that reforming the situation is, you know, just so crazy, I don't get that. I mean...
No, I'm not saying... You know, no, it's nothing... I mean, it's reasonable what he's saying, you know. I don't know what's going on, you know, in the police department here.
Right.
I know the crime has dropped and, you know, nothing really crazy has been happening, or that I know of, at least. Not when it comes to the local police. There's plenty of other craziness in the local government where I live, but not with the police.
No, look, absolutely.
That I know of.
look, absolutely. And this has varied results all over the place. I mean, they completely reformed the police in Camden, New Jersey. They fired everybody and then offered them their jobs back, but we're going to retrain and we're going to do this a different way. And when they did that, crime has fallen off. I mean, Camden, again, not the headline. Everybody thinks of Newark as the dangerous city in Jersey, or Trenton. But frankly, Camden was more dangerous than those places. It was really rough. And the police just trying to clamp down harder and harder on everything and becoming more and more... Well, I mean, I'll use the phrase militarized. Maybe some other people would disagree with me, but the more militarized the police became, the worse the problems got. Once they got them involved in the communities and started, you know, saying, look, it's not about arrests. It's about, you know, actually keeping the peace. It's not about, you know, always searching out criminality and running down people and becoming the automatic enemy when you come into a neighborhood. You know, things have started to shift in Camden. You know, and I'm not saying it's the total solution either, but to say that there is no way to change from the ways of doing things in the past, I mean, defund the police sounds stupid. It just does.
Yeah,
because
sure.
The majority of people are not going to go along with that idea. Oh, you're not going to give money to the police. That's what that means.
well, I'm looking, this book was written in the last couple months of 2020, so
yeah.
That's when this was a hot phrase in the media, you know, and it's no longer such a thing.
It's no longer a hot phrase in the general media, but I assure you, the conservative media, every time they're going to, you know, if this guy somehow comes to any sort of national prominence, Fox News will be talking about he's a guy who wants to defund the police.
That's what
they'll do. And it doesn't matter what he means by defund the police.
No.
They're just going to say, no, he's anti-cop. He's a cop who's anti-cop, you know. Just like this whole weirdness in New York with this Eric Adams, I don't know how that's going to turn out, because he's bringing back the plainclothes cops, I mean. And, man, it's a very strange area. That's exactly the guys who used to do the stop and frisk thing, where they unnecessarily targeted, you know, anybody who wasn't white, pretty much, in the streets heavily. And indeed, they were, you know, violating people's constitutional rights left and right. And they're bringing that unit back and saying, no, we're going to do it better this time. That makes me cringe. You know, the pro-cop mayor, you got to have something other than just somebody who thinks like a cop running the cops. I'm sorry. Or putting the chief of police in, et cetera, et cetera. But then again, you take a look at what Keisha Lance Bottoms did in Atlanta. I don't know if I agree with her either, and she was extremely harsh on the cops in certain places at certain times. And I don't think it was the right thing to do. I mean, one chief of police was fired over that incident where that guy got shot in the Wendy's parking lot, right? And, you know, yeah, somebody burned down the Wendy's and this and that happened, and there was a bit of unrest, but the truth is, I don't think that the chief of police had anything to do with exactly this problem. And it was a minority person that was in charge and everything else. You took out a sympathetic individual just by their life experience. And I don't know if that was the best solution. It was just a knee-jerk reaction to satisfy people who, you know, wanted somebody's head on a plate. And I don't think that's right either. And, you know, and again, we're still confronted by these problems. I mean, look at what happened in Minneapolis recently. A guy with a registered gun and a no-knock warrant. You know, horrible situation there. And truthfully, if they didn't even identify themselves as police, then that's just somebody busting into a door in the middle of the night. And I'll tell you what, if I got a gun, I'm rising up with it too. You know, there's people that are going to say this guy got himself shot, but I think the no-knock warrant thing needs to be dealt with. because it's just wrong. But anyhow, Mike, I don't want to go into these deep things with you about the policing. It's just that you mentioned it. It's just one of those things where it's like, yeah, people don't necessarily understand what it is they're looking at locally a lot of times. They don't know. You know, they got cops that have written books, right? Mayors with different agendas. Business people buying off local politicians. I mean, yeah, you got to pay attention to what's happening in your own community, I think. Anyway, we used to do that all the time. And the point is about this Newark thing, that that was just kind of known quantity in Jersey. We knew about the riots. We knew what it cost. We knew, you know, and frankly, I'm surprised that the death toll is only at 35 in the book you're reading. Because, again, I know there were people that died after. They may have not been counted as victims of the riot. You know what I'm saying? And again, racially charged, big problem. There were a bunch of tense situations that occurred in those streets there that led to it. And like I said, a fairly accurate depiction of it, from my understanding, in the Many Saints of Newark. So, but people would blow out of proportion this whole George Floyd wave that went on across the country and say, oh, this is, you know, absolute chaos. It's worse than that happened before. Never looking at the actual cost. I mean, maybe there was more property damage, even adjusting for inflation, you know, across the country than there was in 67 in Newark. Maybe.
I doubt it, but, well, let's see. I'll try to give you...
Yeah, I'm not sure about that.
That might be. Yeah, but that could be.
That may be, but even so... The loss of life all across the country was not even equal to the one city in Newark. And I assure you that riot in Newark was, yeah, it might have been one of the worst ones, but it wasn't at the top of the list. There's worse things that went on during that time period. I think Watts claimed more people. Detroit might have claimed more people. I'm not sure.
I'm pretty certain that's the case. But I think Watts was the biggest.
I think Watts was the biggest one. To my vague knowledge on this, I haven't read about it in a few years statistically, but Watts was pretty significant.
Like, well, I'm just doing Google searches and what comes up, you know. But it says 34 arrested. Watts was 1965. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, 34 deaths.
34 deaths.
3,400 arrested over 5 days. But I'm pretty... $40 million in property damage...
Well, yeah, $40 million in property damage. If you adjust it for inflation, that's another issue. But again, that amount of people over 5 days, right? Newark, this happened in 2 days, if I remember right. I don't know what that book is counting as the duration of the event, but really it's a 2 day event that, there were still fires after. And like I said, there were still people dying after. I don't know if they're counted. But there was a lot of destruction there and a lot of bloodshed.
Oh, the Detroit one, mm-hmm. I guess that was bigger.
Maybe.
The Detroit one was in 1967, and then this says it was the biggest riot of that year.
Okay.
43 people died in that one.
See, there you go.
400 buildings destroyed, and it was the worst riot in the United States.
Uh-huh.
Since the 1963 New York City draft riots during the Civil War, right?
The
1863 New York City draft riots until the 92 LA riots.
Right. This is what you got to go back to get something bigger than Detroit. But let's put a little perspective on it, right? The events in 65 and 67, okay? So we'll go Watts on the West Coast, we'll go Detroit in the middle of the country, and we'll go New Jersey and Newark on the East Coast. Those three events combined, right, over the course of, let's just call it, 2 weeks. In 2 weeks' time, in just three places in the country, you had more death and more destruction than you did for that whole summer of the George Floyd events. Whole summer that went on. So, you know, again, it's a matter of perspective. It's a matter of honestly examining this stuff. When I looked at some of the analysis from that summer afterwards, it was collected afterwards, I found a serious lack of violence, actually. I found that, just like you did, that very few police officers were killed. I found that Yeah, there was significant property damage in some places, but literally 90%+ of the events that occurred during that summer were not even violent.
Could have been much. The terror, the actual, I don't know. I wasn't alive in the 60s, but there's no doubt there are people terrified. I knew someone that was scared to go out of their house.
Well, you talk to people
because of what they're seeing on the TV.
Well, you talk to people, you know, that lived through that time period in the late 60s in one of those areas. Trust me, they'll tell you about terror. They didn't want to go out. Yeah. They hid in their homes if they could.
Yeah.
Just like this. It's the same thing. It's the same thing. You know what the difference is, though, is that, yes, indeed, CBS News might have shown you, you know, the fires in Watts if you were sitting in Jersey, or the fire in Jersey if you were sitting in California. They might have been able to show that to you a little bit. But they didn't go to 24/7 coverage about, you know, how all of America's on fire. They didn't do that. So the media behaved differently, and people took to social media to draw on this event. And for better or worse, it became larger in people's minds because it was more accessible. But again, as we just said, even the official death counts do not bear this out, that this was even remotely the same size. Again, all across the country, it's beat out by Newark.
Well, this Detroit thing says 16 of the deaths were people in the Army or the police or National Guard. They called in the Army.
Right.
They called in the 82nd Airborne.
Right. But even so, you know, like you brought up the 1863 draft riots in New York. Yeah. And that was horrendous. They just fired from ships in the harbor into New York City, trying to put a stop to the draft riots and the lynchings and everything else that went on. Look, the LA riots was larger. That one riot in Detroit was larger. This does damage to these cities, absolutely. And the thing is, in three instances right there, we just showed you, and then two other instances at different points in history, it was worse, you get it, than that whole nationwide thing put together. And yet there are people that are standing around today saying that that was the worst, absolute worst unrest in the country, and, oh, Antifa, and, oh, they were burning all these cities, and did not even approach the damage if you start combining those events from that time period you're talking about, Mike. Really. Not in the cost of life, not in the cost of property if you adjust for inflation. I assure you, 400 buildings in Detroit, 400 buildings. How much do you think that's worth today?
That's block after block, you know?
Yeah, that's a lot of buildings. That's, you know, what is that? A guarantee of, in today's dollars, even in Detroit in its depressed state? What are we talking about? $500 million right there, minimally?
It's got to be.
Even if these were tenements that were dysfunctional, $500 million right there. Promise you. Not to mention the lost, you know, property and businesses and everything else, which would add to that price tag, I assure you. This, what happened with George Floyd, was next to nothing compared to that. I'm sorry. It just wasn't. As far as the riots, the damage, the violence.
Well, yeah. It just, you know, when I was thinking about this stuff, too, I mean, that it's already been almost 2 years since those 2020 summer riots.
Yep.
You know, in a few months, it'll be 2 years, 5 months from now. And time goes by, and it's just like, well, everyone was going completely, or many people are going completely crazy over this, you know.
Well, and two different security companies who did after-action analysis on this, right, who, you know, surveilled the footage and checked out the reports and took in all the data. Guess what? Again, like I said, 90% of what went on during that summer was peaceful. And then you have a small number of, believe it or not, cops starting violent events. And then you have an even more insignificant number, percentage-wise, in that group where, oh, these people, they just wanted to be radical and loot and burn places, actually did that. It was very small. These other events, you can unpack them one by one and take a look at them historically all you want. Newark has its own motivation, set of circumstances. So does Detroit. So does Watts. So do all of those events. But again, proper perspective is necessary, Michael, don't you think?
Oh, for sure.
Yeah. So anyway, I know I've wound up talking a lot over you, but it is always good to have Mike Swanson on. Again, you know, you might see some of these things brought into other grander perspectives with Mike for different reasons, because he writes about history. He follows and takes a look and re-examines history all the time, but also keeps you up with current events. Be in the know. WallStreetWindow.com, the author of The War State, the author of Why the Vietnam War, Michael Swanson, thank you for doing this hour with me.
Yeah, it's great talking to you again.
All right. In the next hour, J.G. Michael and Joseph L. Flatley will join me. Stick around. The Ocelli Effect continues after this.
WallStreetWindow.com. Gold. Silver. The stock market. WallStreetWindow.com.
Perhaps you're invested deeply.
Perhaps you're not in deep enough. Maybe you're thinking about getting started. WallStreetWindow.com. Michael Swanson, the brilliant author of The War State, understood these trends professionally for many years, and now he gives you the benefit of his knowledge. WallStreetWindow.com. Go there now. Go there now. Go there now.
This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com, and you're listening to The Ocelli Effect at Ocelli.com.
Revelation through conversation.
When a fan of The Ocelli Effect calls in to The Ocelli Effect.
I just wanted to call in and tell you and Michael Swanson and J.P. Sicily and all of the guests that you have how much I love your show. Always interesting. It's always informative. I just wanted to tell you in person on the phone. I mean, I love you. I love your show. I love everything you do. I will always be there to support you. You know that.
We appreciate you so much. You have okay. No idea.
Thanks. And most of our fans just send hate mail and death threats.
Ocelli.com.
Ocelli.com.
Ocelli. Second hour of the Ocelli Effect continues now at Ocelli.com, but you could be listening some other time, some other place, via whatever. So welcome to it, no matter who you are, where you are, or when you are. But for me, it's the second hour on Thursday, so let's get to it. And this time, I've actually got two guys at once on the hour, and I'm really happy there's a good reason for it, because I was kind of a little bit like, wow, when I saw that the Failed State Update is now being co-hosted between Joseph L. Flatley, the great author of a few interesting things out there, including a fascinating book on the so-called Prophet from Pittsburgh. Oh, wait, that's another podcast he did. The book has a different title. We'll get there. But he decided to bring in a co-host, I guess, over on the Failed State Update. And who did he pick? Another one of my favorite people. J.G. Michael from Parallax Views podcast. Now, got to mention that J.G. found it necessary to oversleep last time he was booked for my show. And I told him I was going to break his balls a little bit on the show. So here it is. The guy, it was the funniest thing. I'm like, I hope JG's okay. I'm live. Hello. And I wound up taking calls that night instead and finished out the show. But the plan from now on is to have either Joseph L. Flatley, JG Michael, or both on in the second hour every other Thursday. And that's how we're going to make that all-star team run for Thursdays on the Ocelli Effect. And opposite them, that every other Thursday they're not on, Larry Hancock. So, yeah, pretty solid analysis, interesting people, and a lot of intelligence. Plus, Mike Swanson anchoring the first hour. So, Thursdays are pretty good now. I'm pleased.
Not because Thursday. It's like when they used to have the Cosby Show on.
Yeah, I used to do that on Tuesdays. And right out of the gate, we're going to get to JG too. But first thing is, yeah, I mentioned the Failed State Update. I mentioned the so-called Prophet from Pittsburgh. You have a newsletter that comes out in two versions, one for people that support you and one that I guess some people can get for free. I get a version of that newsletter, and I was kind of stunned when I saw that you were joining forces there, like a Marvel team-up almost, with J.G. Michael. So, Joe, why don't you tell me a little bit about how that happened, and then I'll get to J.G. if he's still awake.
He'd be still awake.
That's a big busting my balls.
I told you I would. Anyway, yeah, Joe, sorry, go ahead.
Oh yeah, it's Oh, yeah. It's a failed state update has become a many-headed Hydra. I guess Hydras are, by definition, many-headed. So, I started this newsletter when we got confirmation in 2020 that the world was falling apart and the United States is falling apart, and that we were in the, we were definitely in a failed state on the move. So I started this newsletter just kind of like, JG and I are colleagues and we're embedded in Pittsburgh, both of us, which I think gives us both a unique and interesting perspective. I started this newsletter just like talk about parapolitics, talk about politics, talk about what I see happening in the Rust Belt.
Right.
And, that became a podcast, that became a website, failedstateupdate.com. And, things are getting out of my control, and I needed some help with the podcast, and JG is, an excellent interviewer, gets excellent guests and is really knowledgeable. So we kind of retooled the podcast a little bit. So we kind of do alternating interviews. I'll interview someone, and then the next episode he'll interview someone, but then we both host it. So we both set up the interview, and then we both give some analysis or just shoot the shit really afterwards.
Right.
So that's the new Failed State Update podcast. And I, it's been going gangbusters. People really seem to like it. And I've really enjoyed doing it. It got me excited about podcasting again, because just being the lone guy talking to strangers over Skype is kind of boring, I think. It's just not for me, but So that's the outlines of the project right there.
Gotcha. And, you're very quirky, and your style is unique, as I've told you before, as a journalist, as a writer, as a podcaster. But why not double down on unique J.G. Michael? Because the guy, I've said it before. Look, I wouldn't necessarily do Parallax Views. That's not the show I would do. Obviously, I do what I do. But the thing is, if you don't respect what he's doing, look, there's a room over there with a rug and some cookies. I mean, you're not very smart if you don't realize that JG's doing some very interesting stuff and really getting in depth on some topics that a lot of other people would fear, and getting into some guests that are relevant all the time, and always doing it with a very unique style. So, Parallax Views is just one of those cool podcasts. I've said it several times. And indeed, he's even been responsible for helping me get a few people on the show. The most recent individual was the guy. I love this, by the way. The guy who did the movie The Pizzagate Massacre. And by the way, I absolutely love that movie now. Like, I saw the trailer. I said, I got to see this. I got to talk to this guy. And I went to JG and he says, yeah, no problem, man. He's always been really cool with me about stuff like that, too, despite the fact that he fell asleep last time he was scheduled to be on the show. So anyway, JG, I'm now done with busting your chops, but told you I would. What did you think? I mean, you guys are both from Pittsburgh, so I mean, there might be a cultural confluence there to some degree, but you and Flatley are different guys for sure. So that's a really, really fascinating dynamic. I wouldn't have thought of it, honestly, but it's a great combination. What's your side of the story there for going over to the Failed State Update?
I think it works out quite well because I think Flatley and I have slightly different styles, maybe. Sometimes I think Flatley grounds me a little bit. I can get way too into abstractions and like, oh, this philosophical thing. And I think Joseph has a tendency to ground me a bit. And I really like the aspect of the banter that Flatley and I have. We do an intro for the show, and then we do a sort of after the interview segment where we talk about what we thought of the interview. And I think there's a real interesting dynamic there because we both, I think, have similar views in a lot of ways, but we also have different ways of approaching the same topics. I don't know if you'd say that's a good way of looking at it, Joseph, but.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And, I don't know if this is a Pittsburgh thing or what, but, I would say Parallax Views and what I do has always been kind of leftist adjacent, you know, like
right.
I don't work for Jacobin, but you know, it's like right. a lot of the same similar topics and interests. And JG definitely is in that realm, but podcasts don't have to be boring and leftists don't have to be boring. And I don't understand why there are so many boring podcasts, but dare I say Failed State Update is not boring. And you know, JG's a funny guy. I have my opinions and, you know, it's great to kind of go toe to toe on some of these topics of, you know, American decline.
Now, I can't say that I don't feel a little bit like I failed my audition, because you and I used to do something called the Bad Ideas Department, which sounds a little similar in what shall we call that structure, where we do an intro, we play a little interview, you get to hear that. Of course, you were always doing the interviews. But yeah. And then we would do commentary afterwards, bit of banter. Never knew where that was going to go.
Oh my dude.
Yeah.
You're not even going to believe it. It never occurred to me that we were doing the same thing as Bad Ideas. Never. I thought this was like a brilliant idea that I had.
It's okay, but now you see the similarity.
Yeah. Definitely.
Except maybe I was a little less left-wing adjacent than JG is. But, you know, I leave that to the judgment of the listener. I don't want to claim a spot on the left or the right. So I have no desire for either. So that's where I'm at. But, yeah, no, I thought that, too. I was like, wow, okay. Actually, JG's a better choice to do that with than me. That's what I thought when I saw it. But we had already sort of done that. Mm-hmm. Anyway, no, but it's great. I love seeing these things evolve. And it makes so much good sense to have the two of you together because, again, you are equally different and also equally the same in that you're different from most people that are doing this, which will bore you to death on the left. I got to tell you, the right-wing guys are usually at least a little more entertaining. Mm-hmm. You know, when they start screaming and crying and talking about their paranoias and I don't know, you know, like you almost develop sympathy for them. The left-wing people are just boring usually, just, I'm here to tell you what's right, and this is the right thing to do, even though I'm on the left, and we must at all times be, and, like, I'm asleep, you know, already, dude. I can't do it. I just, you know.
I think it's a class thing. Like, the lefty podcasts that I find boring, and I won't name any of them because I still find them, the topics fascinating, and I think they do a good job, so I'm not out to, like,
I got you.
Bore shame anybody.
I got you.
But like
bore shaming. What the hell?
Look it up. Ahead, it's a real. It's a real cancelable offense.
I believe you. Go ahead.
But you know, it's like, I think it comes from academia and like, because my friends, you know, you, JG, the people I hang out with, they're all very, just regular working class dudes, and we're interested in the same stuff, and we are, you know. But you got to have a little bit of a sense of humor. I mean, I don't want to beat up on the left too much. Certainly, people love those podcasts and stuff. But I notice a difference when I'm hanging out with those people. It's right. Like, I just want to, you know, get back to the bar. I just want to get back to Gooski's and have a couple brews. I don't need to, like, be...
Amen to that.
See, that's how you know I'm also not on the left, because I guarantee you, me, and JG going to go shoot pool and, you know, maybe drink a couple of beers... We would have a good time. It would not be boring.
That's going to happen one of these days.
One of these days, we've got to make it happen. I you know, I don't mind Pittsburgh, by the way. I'll go visit. But if you guys come down this way, definitely, man, got to do it. Of you has to drive, though. Go ahead, JG.
I was going to say, to be fair, you know, I do feel like flatly we do sort of have a little bit to lefty podcast world. I feel like. You know, Chapo Trap House and the sort of, I guess they're called the dirtbag left. They sort of open the doors for a more wild and woolly approach to left politics in the podcast world.
Sure. Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, it's just, you know, it's something I've noticed, and it's honestly something I've not thought very seriously about. But, you know, Chuck brought it up, so I'm going to talk.
I got you.
Exactly. It's impossible to listen to an NPR episode without falling asleep.
Right. And notice, Chuck, I've been really good about not swearing. I've almost dropped F-bombs and sundry swears many, many times over the last 20 minutes, but I've stopped myself every time.
Listen, points for improvements. I got you. but, you know, before we go any further and before I forget, because I know I'll get lost in something here with you guys, you know, let's talk about the book, by the way, which is going to be featured on the I keep threatening to do this video presentation on my newly formed bookshelf. And your book is on there. And believe me, it's not there just because I have it. I culled a bunch of things out of the books that people have sent me and stuff like that, which, I don't know, people might take offense at a certain point. But your book is going to remain on my shelf in, frankly, in the weird section. You know, look, you got the JFK research section. You know that's going to come on my shelf. You have the general history and literature. And your stuff is going to reside in that section that I don't know where else to put it. But it's nice. Really good. It's really good and stands out because it's this bright green color. And I do have it, but not at arm's length at the moment. So maybe you could give everybody the full title of that book again and remind them.
New Age Grifter, they sent you a physical copy?
Sure did.
Oh, that's good. Love Feral House. Like, fantastic underground publisher, legendary. It's always been like, you know, when I was going to these weird conspiracy theory bookshops in my teens, in my youth, including my favorite one, which was a head shop that sold pot and, you know, pot paraphernalia, obviously not pot, it was illegal, pot paraphernalia and conspiracy theory books. And Robert Anton Wilson actually named it the Grassy Knoll.
Nice.
So that was in Oakland in Pittsburgh, and ever since then it was like, I got to get a book on Feral House. Someday I'll be a writer. And it happened in 2021. The book is New Age Grifter, the true story of Gabriel of Urantia and his cosmic family. And it's a deep dive into an obscure but very much alive and kicking UFO cult in Arizona, mm-hmm. founded by Tony from Pittsburgh. He, you know, his succession of wives left him. He couldn't get a break in the music business. So Tony from Pittsburgh kind of disappeared and reappeared in Arizona, in Sedona, and now he's Gabriel of Sedona. And he's got multiple wives. He's got a compound. He's got a radio station that plays his, like, terrible new age rock music.
Lenny, real quick. Do you think there's, like, anyone in Pittsburgh that's like, hey, whatever happened to Tony? And then they find out about Gabriel, and they're just like, whoa.
Well, actually, funny you should ask. The reason I took this story on is because I was like, he's from Pittsburgh. I'm in Pittsburgh. It's going to be really easy. I won't have to travel. Lots of people will know him and tell me stories.
Right.
They are all freaked out and embarrassed and will not talk about him. It's like, I've, like, you know, gone to people's houses and knocked on their doors and stuck, you know, business cards in their mailbox and called them, and they just don't want to know.
Right.
It's like, he's that embarrassing and weird. It's just like, he was my buddy, and now he's like the new age grifter.
Right. And the great thing about this is you did this podcast on it called The So-Called Prophet from Pittsburgh, and that was excellent, first of all. But secondly, the book goes further, and it's not even a big, huge, thick book. It's actually one of the thinner ones on the shelf, and it's really well done. Again, in the unique style that you have, which I appreciated, even when you put out those pseudo zine kind of pieces, I thought those were great because they just looked like a throwback all by themselves. But then again, I could sympathize. I mean, if someday you were to turn your investigative journalist powers to my life for some reason, guaranteed there's people in Jersey that would be like, I'm not talking to you about him. Indeed, I was a failed musician, you know, who had a couple of wives. So, you know, I'm just saying maybe I'd have a few sympathies, but not when I start reading Flatley's work on this. I don't. It's like, oh, man, this guy is so strange and so well ignored by many people who even are, you know, I don't know if I want to call them cult followers of cults, but there are people out there that are very much invested, it seems, when it comes to their journalistic pursuits about following people like this. And they ignored this guy. This guy is entirely fascinating. I mean, that radio commercial, by the way, when we were talking about the
yes.
the radio commercial they broadcast from a radio station, do they own it, right? They
yes,
own the
yes,
one radio?
Their radio station that they own, and they built just to play his music because no other radio station ever would in a million years.
And if you hear the music, you know why. But the fact that they have this commercial to like recruit people into the cult on the radio station, it's like it is the creepiest, weirdest thing. What was it? Come ye and join or something.
Oh yeah, it was like come hither or come yeah, it was
some like, sort of like pseudo biblical.
It's not as good as Sun Ra and his orchestra.
No
one knows what I'm talking about.
Yeah, people know what you're talking about. The difference is Sun Ra was a genius.
Yes, exactly.
And Gabriel Vierancha is no Sun Ra. Let's put it that way.
And look,
Gabriel was sort of like.
and Jim Jones produced much better choir music.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. You know, weird.
And and Mark Jacobson, friend of the show, excellent journalist and William Cooper biographer, wrote the intro to New Age Grifter, and he, you know, and the whole introduction is about like the cosmic Woodstock of like, where would Gabriel fit? You know, between like Manson and Jim Jones and all these figures, and he decided that he wouldn't rank that very high; that he would fit at the bottom.
No, he's definitely like, you know, if this was baseball, he's playing in, you know, maybe double A, as opposed right. to the major leagues. I mean, this is a guy. Yeah, I played double A baseball. Yeah, never heard of you. I mean, this is pretty much where he should stand. But again, somehow longevity in the cult world.
Uh-huh.
You know, which is another weird aspect to this. But, of course, you guys can learn all about it, New Age Grifter. And, you know, if you haven't turned around and checked out the podcast, The So-Called Prophet from Pittsburgh, I advise you to go get all the episodes that you can. Because, man, it is more than entertaining and informative. Again, quirky style of Joseph L. Flatley intact the entire time, which I love, by the way. And, you know, speaking of quirky, let's turn over to JG for a second directly because, as I mentioned, the Pizzagate massacre, that, I'm telling you, man, really serious. That was a great, great turn on right there. You interviewed the director and a guy who acted in it, right? Briefly, and I love the role he chose to play in that movie, by the way. It's hilarious to me. That's the guy behind the movie. I don't know if you heard the interview I did with him. I'm sure it was very, very different.
I did listen to your interview with him. Okay. I was joking with John Valley, who directed it, and as you said, stars in it. And I told him after I interviewed him, I said, you know, we just did 2 hours and 10 minutes. I feel like this is strange because this is actually longer than the running length of the movie. I think he kept it a bit more compact. And in some ways, I think he did a better job in that way because, you know, who has time to listen to a two-hour podcast?
Well, see, that's what I would have thought, but, you know, some people do. And the thing with him, though, was that is a serious piece of art, I mean, to me. Because I meant to ask you about these things and was holding it until I could get you on the show. But the best thing about this is probably the cinematography as opposed to even the script writing. Which, again, look, it's clearly not, you know, A-level Hollywood glam gloss, you know. But it
looks professional as hell.
Well, it looks professional as hell. But the weird thing to me is it reminds me of something I would have pulled out of a VHS bin. When I was a kid, like, here's a good crazy movie to watch with my friends, right? It actually looks and kind of feels like it's something that was, you know, camcorder age independent film, but way professional at the same time. Did you get that sense of, like, this is, like, almost a throwback sort of piece of cinema when you saw it?
Definitely, definitely. It reminded me a lot of, like, the old John Carpenter movies. And it sort of had a road movie vibe to it, so I was sort of thinking of a lot of the old Sam Peckinpah type films, you know, Bring Me the Head of Alfredo Garcia and other cult classics like that. It definitely had that vibe of, you know, if I would have seen it in a video store when I was, you know, 13 or whatever, I would have been like, whoa, what's this? You
right.
know, it would have caught my eye. I definitely got that impression. And this leads me to saying, Lenny, when are we going to get New Age Grifter turned into a movie? I feel like John Waters could do it justice.
Oh, wow.
I can't talk about that, actually. We'll talk off the air.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
I knew nothing.
Good teaser, and apparently JG didn't know. So, okay, we'll leave it there. But that sounds like an interesting movie. Although, I got to say that this week I was exposed to something called Crackhead Jesus. So, you know, the strange cinema is endless out there if you're looking for it, just so you know. I don't know if you guys are familiar with that one. The serial killer doctor.
No, but I just Googled it. I'm like, I gotta see something called Crackhead Jesus.
Yeah, Victor Hugo Vaca was the guest of, and he's the director of that short film, was the guest of Donald Jeffries yesterday. And I got to tell you, my head's still sort of spinning from the guy. Nice. And the film is truly a bizarre piece of work that I almost feel like I want to suggest it to you for an article, Joe, because it's that bizarre. And I know you love to go, hey, look, you know how you think things are strange in the news? Let me show you what's really strange. I love how you do that. And JG's, you know, unconventional again, maybe a little more enthusiasm. And I could see, I can't imagine Joe grounding a lot of people, but grounding JG actually makes perfect sense. So all of that, I love both of these guys, by the way, just in case anybody's even guessing. And I appreciate their style, which is far different than my own, but, okay. So let's get back to this a little bit more. What is coming up on, well, let's start with Parallax Views, because I'm always fascinated by the interesting guests that you get, because you pay about as much attention to convention as I do when it comes to, does it make sense that you brought this guest on and this guest on? No, it doesn't. If you're trying to put me in a box, it does not work. But if you understand the thought process, yeah, it does. So I get where you're going a lot of times. Again, even though I wouldn't venture there, what do you got coming up on Parallax Views that people want to be on the lookout for?
Oh, I've got a bunch of episodes coming out. I don't want to give too much away, but I think an episode that would be of particular interest to your audience, Chuck, is I just had Matt Alford and Tom Secker, who famously wrote a book called National Security Cinema. Mm-hmm. They have a new documentary coming out, I believe in March. It was supposed to come out on Valentine's Day, but they've pushed it back. It's a documentary called Theaters of War, which is about the Pentagon and the CIA's involvement in Hollywood over the years. Mm-hmm. And they even managed to get Oliver Stone in the documentary to talk about this. So it's a really interesting conversation we had about all the different movies that the Pentagon has been involved in, from, you know, Black Hawk Down to, well, believe it or not, a newer movie, Don't Look Up, the movie that a lot of leftists are big fans of because it deals with climate change.
Gosh.
But turns out it's got DOD support behind it, which is,
I guess, so if they're going through into the Pentagon and stuff, it's like, I mean, they could do a Doctor Strangelove thing and have, you know, and build the war room on a soundstage in London or something, but I'm sure they were dealing with DOD.
That's the thing, though, is people will say, well, you know, it doesn't really have an effect on, like, the movies themselves. They're just, you know, using the Pentagon's equipment, which isn't true. Like, the Pentagon will say, you know, something along the lines of, oh, we're just making sure that everything's historically accurate. But you look at, for instance, the TV show NCIS, they were actually told to change an entire script, or maybe it was that they were given a script by the Pentagon dealing with sexual assault in the military. And the way the Pentagon wanted them to portray it was that, oh, it's actually this survivor not wanting to talk about the abuse that's the problem. And, you know, these good leaders in the Pentagon and then the military, they want the truth, and they would handle this well. When, you know, the reality, it seems like in real life, has been that, you know, it's been about pushing a lot of these scandals to the side. So in a way, you know, this relationship between Hollywood and the Pentagon, and also on the other end of that, the CIA with Chase Brandon, actually affects the movies we watch. You know, a movie like Iron Man started out as having Tony Stark go to war with the military-industrial complex. By the time the Pentagon got involved with that movie, you know, the screenplay changed entirely, and you know, it becomes pretty defense pro-military. Contract. Yeah.
So, did you have Alex Walker on your show? Am I remembering that correctly?
I haven't had Alex Walker. I'm not familiar.
I mean, I'm sorry, Alex Walker. Alex Cox, director of Walker.
Yes, Alex Cox I have had on the show. Yeah, we've talked about The Parallax View, actually, the movie.
Nice. Well, he has a great book if anybody's like a wannabe filmmaker. It's called 10 Films. It's okay. Like letter X and then the word films. And it's just like his diary making like his first 10 films. And he tells this story in Walker, which, you know, was about the America's involvement in Nicaragua, and a lot of it was supposed to be filmed in Nicaragua, and then it was supposed to be filmed in Mexico, and then I don't remember exactly where it ended up being, but in order to film in Mexico, because it was, you know, it was 1985, 1986, it was still basically a Catholic, authoritarian state, so heavy censorship, so they had to, like, give the script to the censor to like get the okay to film the movie. Right. And he said that the censor was like, he had been doing it for so long, he just had a really great sense of like pacing and story structure, and like just gave them a lot of notes that really improved the script. So
strange.
You never know what you're going to get with the censor.
Yeah, well, and there you go. A guy who's so familiar with having to edit these things already might say, you know, I got some other edits to suggest because I've already seen this go different ways. It's funny stuff. I mean, have you guys ever encountered, and JG, maybe during this whole thing with Secker and all, did 7 Days in May come up during that discussion at all?
7 Days in May did not come up, but I want to have Tom on again to talk about that.
Okay.
Although I was able to shoehorn the one thing I wanted to talk about with Tom for like a year now on my podcast, which is why the Pentagon rejected Attack of the Killer Tomatoes. They literally rejected that film.
They did.
And that will always blow my mind until the end of time, because, wow, what a stick up their butt do they have to hate Attack of the Killer Tomatoes.
I will never understand that myself. Like, that's, you know, I mean, clearly that's the, the typical go-to when it's like, oh, let's talk about terrible movies.
They didn't even reject it because it had anything to do with the Pentagon. The Pentagon said, well, this, you know, mocks the White House. Well, I didn't, I don't know. It's not mocking the Pentagon. Why do you care?
You'd think. But, you know, you're asking for logic out of, people that have policies. I mean, it's just
that was simple. An 80s movie, right? That was like early 80s.
I think it was even the 70s.
Oh, was it the 70s? Right. Yeah. Because my theory was that if it was mocking the Carter White House, it would be okay. But the Reagan White House, they'd have problems. But
you could be.
Put a lie to that theory.
But then again, you know, if it was, you know, Ford, I mean, you know, come on, give the guy a break already. And if it was, you know, if it was Nixon, who knows, maybe they ended up on the enemies list. So, you know, 70s. But Carter, no, I don't think the Carter administration would have been that worried about it. You know, they were too busy trying to put the wrong guy in at the CIA. So, you know, I don't think they had a handle on that kind of stuff. They weren't, you know, in lockstep with one another, the Pentagon and the Carter administration, obviously. But anyway, there's a lot more to it, though. It's just interesting. 7 Days in May, though, is one of those things that I've always been fascinated by, because some people in passing, you know, bring up the whole thing about Kennedy letting them film, in the White House, specifically being away so they could, which he didn't have to do, and all that. And it's kind of a fascinating story to me. But I've never, you know, never had a good dissection of that whole thing. But like I said, people mention it in passing all the time, right? So, anyways.
You know what's weird to me is 7 Days in May is a great movie, but it reminded me now that, you know, all of a sudden, I hear a lot more people talking about General Smedley Butler and the whole Wall Street putsch, the business plot. And I think of that because, you know, 7 Days in May has a sort of coup storyline to it. But it's really weird to me how all of a sudden everyone is talking about the business plot against FDR and how General Smedley Butler foiled it. I guess this is because January 6th, now it's become acceptable to talk about. But for years, everyone used to say, oh, that's kooky conspiracy stuff. I guess we want to get on that one. You know, I guess we're not the conspiracy people anymore.
Yeah, and don't forget, I mean, that comes and goes in waves, the prominence of the, you know, war is a racket thing. Because if you recall, around the time, say, Alex Jones did the Obama deception, right? Which was, you know, him coming into office and all that. So that's got to be, what, 2008? Around there, I mean, I don't remember exactly, but I do remember the film coming out, and he mentions it in there and was definitely mentioning it all the time, and all of his little clones did. So, you know, that was certainly something that was prominent for a while, about 15 years ago. But then it sort of died out. People stopped paying attention to it. You know, how can you have a business plot? Of course, Trump's here to save us all, so don't worry about it. You know.
Have you seen Executive Action, the Burt Lancaster movie?
Oh, of course. Yeah.
Oh, that. Now that, I think, is up there in the pantheon of assassination, JFK assassination.
Is that the one that was written by Mark Lane?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Donald Freed. Yeah, it's like Dalton Trumbo actually wrote the screenplay, but yeah, Donald Freed and Mark Lane wrote the story.
Yeah. You know what I used to have is a little handout that they gave out when that movie was in theaters. Yeah, obviously I didn't go to see it when it was in a theater. I was too young, but later on somebody else handed me this thing, and it was like, this is what they used to give out at that movie in certain places, like, in, you know, because I was near New York, so the benefit of people hanging on to things going, I don't have any use for this, but you might be interested. So one day somebody handed me this thing, and I was like, wow, there was a bunch of, you know, articles on the JFK conspiracy. I mean, just... And it was just like this weird sort of photocopied thing, you know, 1970s style Xeroxing, though, you know.
Right.
And it was like, huh, this is interesting that, you know, somebody was trying to use this as a way to gain awareness for all of the assassination research that had gone on, it looked like to me. I even think Mary Farrell might have actually been one of the articles that was copied into it at the time. So. And, you know, and I kind of held on to it as a curiosity for some time. It might still be in my storage in Jersey, but I don't know. It, you know, a lot of things have come and gone in my possession over the years. But anyway, it's that's a fascinating story. And, of course, you mentioned Oliver Stone, JG, a little while ago. Bit of a big to-do made about the recent documentary there. However, it's had a little bit of difficulty getting distributed in the U.S., still waiting for them to put out a physical copy of the 4-hour version of it. But, you know, because when they do, I definitely want one. Hint, hint, if anybody's listening, I definitely want one. You know, I'll probably wind up buying it. But either way, there's a whole, you know, interesting cinematic shift that's occurred regarding conspiracy theory and conspiracy reality. And the production of film and television as being marshaled in some cases by government agencies is, again, was something that people thought was, you know, just the fevered dreams of people that saw conspiracies everywhere.
Right.
But over time, we're discovering, there just may be something that goes on like that all the time.
It is. It is so crazy when you look at what Tom Secker and Matt Elford have done. Just the amount of, I mean, I don't know how Tom Secker does it. I think he's actually referred to as a vexatious filer of FOIAs by these agencies, because they're like, why do you have to do this? But he has like thousands of documents, I think, at this point. I mean, he's uncovered thousands of movies, even now, that are coming out that have some type of connection to the DOD, mm-hmm. Or in some cases the CIA, and it's so wild. I mean, even a Suicide Squad was another one that came up recently that he got FOIA documents on, and I'm just thinking, wow, that this rabbit hole goes deep.
Yeah. Well, and that's the fun part about FOIA documents. If nobody ever requests them, believe me, they're not going to just voluntarily drop them out there. Mm-hmm. Even though they've really taken the teeth out of the Freedom of Information Act, in my opinion, over the past few years, you know, it doesn't bite as hard as it did, but it still kind of works. So,
Mac McGee, I don't know. I know you've spoken to Laura Johnston Cole. My mental Rolodex is going through all the people in the Jonestown, former Jonestown community. Mac McGee, who co-founded the Jonestown Institute with Rebecca Moore, he says that he's been the day after Jonestown, so November 19th, 1978, he started filing FOIA requests. Right. So he's the longest, most successful, most prolific FOIA person I know. Mm-hmm. And he said what they do now is it was twofold. First, they just sent you everything so you could never hope to go through it. Right. And then as soon as COVID hit, they just stopped responding to all requests. They said, you know, COVID exists. We could never, you know, respond to your FOIA requests. And it's there has to be a way for one lone researcher in a basement somewhere to not, you know, to not get sick with COVID if they you know, check your request. Well, it's obviously total BS.
You got to remember, on a grander scale, just this past year, right, we got some more JFK assassination-related documents dumped because of the JFK Records Collection Act. And, you know, 25 years after this stuff was set to be released, Trump turns around and gives in and says, oh, you need more time? Okay, kicks it down the road. Biden grabs it, pretty much agrees again, and adds that, we're going to have to further delay these things because of COVID.
Yeah, not to change subjects here, but have you guys heard about this stuff with Trump and him ripping up, presidential records?
Yeah, yeah.
I was talking to Lindsay Travinsky today, who is a presidential historian, and she's like, this is completely wild that he was literally trying to flush them down the toilet. But apparently Trump wants us to know the truth, or so his supporters tell me.
Well, you know, and the funny thing about that is anybody who's a presidential historian will tell you that sometimes this does happen where a document is ripped up and some poor fool has to reconstruct it. You know, but in this case, it was tirades of tearing up many documents, apparently, which is a little unusual. I mean, you know, occasionally something out of frustration or whatever gets torn up. And, you know, presidential records collection is a really, really arduous task because...
Yeah. Wasn't there a story about like when Trump just got into office and he didn't understand how things worked, they would have people go into the Oval Office after he went to bed at 6 p.m. and go through the trash bin and take out all the documents and tape them back together so they could submit them or whatever.
Yeah, apparently somebody was trying to do the... Because legally, every document that's produced in the White House in the course of presidential business is supposed to be preserved, which is really, really tough, too, because some of this stuff is now digital. That literally means that every tweet that Trump produced as a president should be collected as part of his presidential records. You know, I'm just saying, it's a lot of stuff. That's a lot of covfefe. That's a lot of, you know,
that's
you're a loser.
Lot of covfefe.
You're a loser. This one's terrible. They're sick. You know, I mean, I'm voicing it now. But we read this for, 5 years, and all of it is actually now relevant. You know, going through Kennedy's stuff, you find, incomplete letters and all kinds of, really pointless things that they collected. And you know, I don't even know how anybody really regulates that, where it's like, you know, how do you know that everything that was written down wasn't, you know, how do you know that some of it wasn't destroyed? I always wonder about the check marks on that, because that's never been entirely clear. even though there's people
Chuck,
that are employed.
I was actually going to ask you if I could real quick.
Sure.
I was thinking about that today in terms of, you know, I assume there were actually documents shredded when, you know, the church committee was going after, you know, the CIA and different agencies. I think that was even confirmed that, like, there's a lot of MKUltra documents that haven't survived. But I wanted to ask you about that, actually.
Yeah, well, see, now, when you get into the CIA's documents versus the president, it's a different thing, first of all.
Definitely.
You know, but secondly, when you're talking about the document shredding, remarkable thing about this whole thing with MKUltra is that, frankly, they destroyed almost all the documents. They just forgot to destroy the financial stuff. And somebody had to forensically reconstruct what happened from the financial documents that, if Dulles had remembered to destroy them, we might have no concrete proof about MKUltra, honestly.
Right. That's what one of the things that's so vexing about understanding MKUltra is, like, we're literally trying to, like, surmise what happened in this program with, like, just seeing the very, very tippy top of the iceberg. You know, it's like, it's almost impossible, I think, to really know the full extent either way. That's why, you know, people who are trying to, like, talk about it as if nothing ever happened, or people that are trying to talk about it as if, you know, Roseanne Barr was targeted in the 80s or whatever. Well, you know, it's like they're all just making shit up. It's almost impossible.
Well, and the other problem, again, just slightly against your point, but the other problem here that actually makes it worse is that, frankly, CIA programs, it's like having hamsters that are male and female in a cage. They keep making others. You know, MK Ultra gave birth to MK Delta, MK Naomi, you know, and various other programs that we know of, and guaranteed there were other programs that are still as yet unknown. Like I would bet on it with anything you wanted to bet. I would bet that.
Although it didn't happen on purpose, the fact that the scant few documents about MKUltra did survive is like the smartest thing the CIA could have done, because everybody's obsessed with that.
Right.
Nobody's talking about the torture programs, all the things that weren't these like obscure, novel, weird attempts at mind control that the CIA did and continues to do. So it's like, it's the perfect smokescreen.
Well, and then it takes us decades to dig through things like Operation Phoenix and, you know, and that's the other thing is, don't forget that, you know, simultaneously, the Pentagon is running their own programs. So it's not just the CIA. That's always a weird thing, too. When people say, oh, you know, the OSS became the CIA, that's not even as simple as that. There were three different agencies that were folded into the CIA, and nobody even talks about one of them at all. Which is commonly referred to as the Pond, which was a whole separate institution. And the OSS was kind of in competition with the CIA at first, and eventually got folded into it, was defunded, so to speak. And some of the OSS people did not take to it too well going into the CIA. There's a whole weird story there even.
Nobody even knew that the Pond existed in 2001. Until like 2001.
Right.
So like, how many other pawns are there, you know?
Well, that's the thing. And there's, you know, various other adjunct programs that were just born out of necessity in certain locations. Like, you know, there might have been something that was formulated on the ground in a place like Laos or Cambodia that nobody talks about. Because, you know, none of those documents survived, or nobody's asked the DOD for them. Again, Freedom of Information Act stuff aside, you have to know what you're asking for and where you're asking for it, you know.
And how to ask for it.
And how.
Yeah, you it's, know. That actually, so much of this just reminds me of our recent episode, JG's and mine. We did Jim Brewer from the UFO Trail appeared on the last
Jack
episode.
Brewer.
Jack Brewer.
Yeah, Jim Brewer's the comedian. I was going to say, wait a minute, you got that guy on?
Okay. Oh, no. Oh, no, we got Jim Brewer to talk about UFOs.
That would be really remarkable, but okay, sorry. Go ahead.
No, all right, I'm about three deep into the Iron City, so...
Cool. It's all right.
Sorry, Jack. But I mean, that was the whole thing. That was like the whole thing with the intelligence community interface with NICAP and with the UFO community. Is it's just like, if you have half a dozen ad hoc programs run by, you know, mavericks, for lack of a better word, like Richard Doty, not only could that be much more destructive than like an official CIA program, but nobody will ever trace that. It'll be completely invisible to history.
Right. Well, that's the thing, is that some things will remain invisible to history without a little bit of luck, too. You know, unfortunately,
we'll only learn about them years after the fact. I don't know. I don't know if you guys heard about that new documentary that came out. I think it was like a Danish radio documentary called "The Search for Myself." Hmm. It was about the CIA conducting MKUltra experiments in, of all places, Copenhagen.
Yes,
and, it involved orphans in these Danish orphans in Copenhagen, and. You know, it's weird because no one talks about this, you know, big new documentary. I mean, it should have been, you know, I would think it would have been interesting to all these people that are really into MKUltra. But instead, people talk about this sensationalistic softcore garbage like Project Monarch, which I'm sorry, I don't believe it exists.
Well, of course it doesn't exist. But like, or they'll take, you know, the Danish thing and be like, see, the Finders were really... satanic child abusers. And it's like nobody's actually, you know, I mean, the conspiracy community, our community, which I love and, you know, have been involved in for many, many years, is also complete garbage. It's so frustrating.
You know, it's got a lot of, yeah, exactly. I love it and hate it too. And it's got a lot of garbage in it, unfortunately. I'll tell you the weirdest, as we're running out of time here, the weirdest recent drop of somebody even mentioning MKUltra for me was, I don't know if you're familiar with the story of Rose Sheremy. JG, do you know who Rose Sheremy was?
Yeah, so in the movie, in Oliver Stone's JFK,
right.
At the beginning, the character that's like, they're going to kill the president.
Right.
That's based on Sheremy, yeah.
Exactly. That's based on Sheremy. It's not a composite character. It's based on a story about her directly. Do you, Joe, know who Rose Sheremy is? You know that story,
no,
basically?
Not at all. I'm reading her right up on Spartacus Educational right now.
Okay, fair enough. But anyway, she was, in short, she was a dope runner and a whore that worked for Jack Ruby. And she was in a car with some guys days before the assassination.
I remember this.
Who were talking about doing it. And she gets thrown out of the car, left on the side of the road anyway, not necessarily thrown out of the car like in the movie, but either way, gets into an argument with these guys at a bar, gets left on the side of the road, ends up wandering, gets hit by a car, ends up in a hospital. Okay. And she tells law enforcement people that it's going to happen before it happens. So I had on her son just the other night, who wrote a book about it. A book about his mom. He spent a very long time researching, tracking down what happened. It's a very interesting and you know, interesting from a personal perspective, but also in that he goes deep into the story of his mother, who is Rose Sheremy, who had a different legal name, by the way. But anyway,
now, I wanted to ask real quick: does he go beyond just that one aspect of the story? Because it seems like there's a lot of different threads that he could be untangling.
Way beyond it. It's called Rose Sheremy, Gathering Fallen Petals is the name of the book. And it is deep. Now, I didn't read the whole book by the time I got him on the show, because I got it the day before. But I knew the story enough and I skimmed through. Thing is, though, one of the things he mentions in there, and I did not track it down or double check what he asserts, but he actually feels as though she might have been part of MK Ultra experimentation at a certain point. You know, and I find these odd threads that show up in different places. And by the way, Michael Marcades is his name. He's done really a good job of real research. This is not a guy clicking on links on the internet. You understand? This is a guy who went and got the paperwork, who went and met with people, who actually collected the physical documents, who went and got medical records, et cetera, et cetera. His research is, to my opinion, exactly the old school kind of research that used to get real solid work done, except he's done it on his mother. And really, really fascinating story in and of itself. But that's the weirdest extra drop. And a lot of times you find these weird kind of like add-ons. And some people, I think, do it, you know, for effect. Other people, I think, legitimately feel as though they've stumbled across something. And I have not judged what Michael Marchetti's came up with yet, but I will explore it on the show. And in fact, JG, I would suggest that Michael Marchetti's might be a good guest for you.
Get me in touch with him.
Definitely.
Oh, you know who would be a good guest for me? Failed State Update?
Who's that?
Chuck Ocelli. I have some like very serious questions about not just the JFK assassination, but more importantly, like the JFK research community.
Oh boy.
I want to like get to the bottom of it. Get to the bottom of some of these questions.
You know who you should talk to Chuck about some of the crazy patriot or PAYtriot movement stuff, because Chuck has an insight into a lot of that scam artist BS.
Nice. Yeah. Well, we'll talk about that too, but I have like very, you know, I think that like the JFK assassination is fascinating because it's like, mm-hmm. not only is it it's of historical import, so, like there's no doubt about that.
Right.
But on top of that, it's like, it's the like defining conspiracy that spawned this movement. And I think kind of understanding that scene can not only tell you what the conspiracy scene has brought to history, but also like how it's kind of like damaged history by like promoting a lot of dingbats. So I really want to like get into your brain, Chuck. Get into the mind of Chuck Ocelli.
Listen, I'll be more than happy to do it whenever you're ready. Let me know. And I agree mm-hmm. with your thesis statement to begin with, just so you know. A lot of damage done and also a lot of good work done simultaneously through this very, very weird sort of thing that is the assassination research community concerned with JFK. A lot of ins and outs on that. And yeah, no black and white, though. A lot of gray area, mm-hmm. my friend. Mm-hmm. A lot of gray area. Anyway, before we run way over time, Joseph L. Flatley, now I know we can find your stuff at LennyFlatley.net. I know we can find both of you now at failedstateupdate.com. Am I missing any other websites that you would want to tell us about, Joseph L. Flatley?
No, go to failedstateupdate.com for the news, the new Failed State Update website. And I guess LennyFlatley.substack.com. That's my newsletter. Yeah. If you want to kick in a few bucks, that would be great. I desperately need it. If you do that, whenever I do like a large investigative feature or report, you'll get it before it goes on the website. If you don't want to kick in any money because you're a son of a bitch or you're just broke, that's fine too. Sign up for free and you'll get weekly updates of everything that's on the site.
Right. And also I would advise you to buy the book, which is New Age Grifter. It is the one with the green cover, and I like the physical copy. It's on Feral House, and I'll give you the links to all that. But meanwhile, JG Michael, I'm probably going to give something of your social media, and I used to give out, what was it, the Parallax Views Podbean page, but is there anything else new besides also they can go find you at Failed State Update now, because failedstateupdate.com is the place to go for the podcast, but it's also available where a lot of other podcasts are as well, you know, kind of like this show, and so is yours. But anything else that we need to point out to people, JG Michael?
Yeah, real quick, if people could go to my Patreon page, patreon.com/parallaxviews. I just had a donor or two dip out, a patron or two dip out, so I'm looking for some new people that, you know, would be willing to kick me a few dollars, maybe. It's tough, as Flatley said, so I would really appreciate it. I do about 3 to 4 shows a week, and I hope everyone enjoys those shows. And also, if I can, I just want to plug the fact that I interviewed Roger Waters last week from Pink Floyd. And it was funny, Chuck, because I was thinking of you during that interview. Me and him were supposed to talk. Well, it was a three-way call with a Professor Sut Jolly on as well. But Roger was supposed to talk about Israel-Palestine and his activism with relation to that. But he ended up going off about how much he hates the 1% and how Republicans and Democrats are the same. And I just thought to myself, he is a loose cannon, much like my friend Chuck O'Chelly.
I love that. Roger Waters and me, apparently. You never know what you're going to get when you make a call with us. Yeah, fair enough. J.G. Michael and Joseph L. Flatley, my guests in the second hour on the O'Chelly Effect tonight. Michael Swanson in the first hour. And as far as I'm concerned, that's a hell of a Thursday. Check out all their stuff online and elsewhere. And remember this, I am merely O'Chelly. All of you are the effect. Good night.